anonymous sponsorship tonight. Anonymous sponsor, thank you, whoever you are. Don't know if you're here. Don't know if you're not here. But I don't know if that means... Okay, I'm just not going to say anything. It was you. Do you want me
it
to...
It was me because I thought that Loretta, who dedicated herself to Young Israel Beaucourt, you know, deserved to have something.
Yes. You know. No, you're right. Loretta Blumenfeld, she was the secretary for, what, 10 years?
At least
probably more.
More than 10 years.
Yeah, that was nice. That was very nice.
So, thank you for the anonymous sponsorship from those who know was just talking. You know who it was. But thank you for the sponsorship. A very nice idea that the secretary of the shul passed away last week or a couple weeks ago. So it is our merit, still her merit, regardless of this class, to have this class. And I'm sure she did a lot for the shul to keep it running and going smoothly. So we learned tonight, the least we could do is learn tonight L'ilui Nishmasa for the elevation of her soul. And do we have a doozy tonight? So interestingly enough, usually this is the Mishle slot. Let me just make sure that people can hear me. Okay. Usually this is the Mishle slot, but because it's the first week of the Hebrew month of Sivan, so as we usually do, we switch over to legends and lessons to do a Yahrzeit class. Talk about a prominent rabbinic, a prominent Jewish leader in history. And even though this morning we spoke a lot about history and rabbinic leadership in early America, so here tonight we're doing more history. But this history is not in any way going to resemble the history we talked about this morning. As you can imagine, the early American rabbinate was very, worldly. Right? A lot of languages. We spoke about Rabbi Bernard Eloi. We spoke about Rabbi Morris Raphael. We spoke about Rabbi Sabato Moraes. All very well educated in multiple ways. Very well educated and well rounded. And that's what allowed them to come to America and really be successful in that way. I just want to point out that Leonard and Shoshana are both on my screen. And Leonard is on the left, Shoshana's on the right. And because Shoshana is listed as Pollock and Leonard's listed as Leonard, so it says Leonard Pollock. I just wanted to point that out. There's a certain hashgacha to how you guys sit on my screen. So I guess, Leonard, you're at work and Shoshana's at home. That's what I'm assuming. either way, it's very cute. but yes, so as opposed to the worldly, very well-educated rabbinate of America, specifically early America. Tonight we have a figure in Jewish history that really changes the game. Changes the game in terms of what kind of education a person needs to really prosper, not only for himself, but also for the rest of his rest of the movements. And that is none other than Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer. I remember when I spoke about this Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, I think I might have... publicized the shir as Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, and no one knew who I was talking about. Rabbi Yisrael, well, it's not even Rabbi Yisrael, but Yisrael ben Eliezer is more well known as the Baal Shem Tov. Now, what in the world does Baal Shem Tov mean? So the word Baal usually means the owner of, or the person of. The word Shem usually means name, and Tov means good. So if one were to translate literally Baal Shem Tov, so then the name of the Baal Shem Tov would be the person with a good name, right? But the truth is that has nothing to do with it. Now, that has maybe a sort of hashkacha aspect to it, a sort of spiritual essence to that, why his name became that, I don't know. But what really goes behind his name historically is the fact that there were people called Baalei Shem. And this concept of a Baal Shem is of much historical, controversy, but it's not really a controversy, but sort of mystery. Now, what exactly do these Baalei Shem do? I see a few people here that are in the Daf Yomi, and you might remember that a couple months ago, we had a few different dafim that brought up the concept of a kamiya being brought on Shabbos. We talked about a kamiya a couple days ago, but not in the same way. Can you carry an amulet on Shabbos? So what exactly is an amulet? The Gemara goes through that these were sort of like different types of writings that would help you get past certain sicknesses. And the Gemara basically comes out and says, well, the ones that you can carry are the ones that work, right? The ones that don't work, so you're not allowed to carry them, right? Those are useless, those are muktzah, whatever. So the question is, what in the world does that mean? So these amulets, I think Rashi even explained on the Gemara, oftentimes invoked certain phrases or names of Hashem in order to bring a certain sense of spiritual healing that translated into a sense of physical healing. And these amulets, despite the fact that maybe nowadays we can't really understand them, or maybe we don't really know how to use them, they were very, very popular all the way up until the 19th century, really. And I'm sure they're still around today, but not in the same common way that they were back then. And the people that used to make these amulets were called Baalei Shem. The Baalei Shem were people who would scribble these things on the paper. Sorry for being a little flippant when I say scribble these things on the paper. The truth is, historically, there were many fake Baalei Shem. And the reason that they were able to get away with this, meaning get away with just writing things down on pieces of paper and selling them to people, is because by and large, the people of that generation, we're talking about the 18th century, the people of that generation were oftentimes very undereducated. They did not know a lot. They could probably read or write very little, if any. And they were still yearning. They were still yearning for connections. They were still yearning for healing. And they would come to these people who claimed to be Baalei Shem and ended up being fakes. But this is how these Baalei Shem used to make money. However, there were some Baalei Shem who distinguished themselves not as tricksters and not as fakers, but rather as real, good Baalei Shem. And this is how Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer got the name Baal Shem Tov. He wasn't just one of these other Baalei Shem that scribbled things down and told you that this thing's going to work, this thing's going to help you and heal you, but rather he was the real thing. But the truth is that we've got to rewind a little bit, as best as we can, to try to figure out how the Baal Shem Tov became the Baal Shem Tov. Because no one's born out of the womb writing down amulets. He's actually got to learn something in order to have that ability. So the truth is that there's a lot of legend and mystery surrounding the Baal Shem Tov's upbringing. Part of that is because we have very, very little documentation about the Baal Shem Tov. It wasn't even until the 90s that we could confirm that he existed. It was only after the Iron Curtain fell that you could actually go into, that researchers went into those areas in near Mezhebezh, and they could find different documents and different confirmations of his existence. Most notably, there was a certain tax document that says on it Baal Sam, which, you know, means Baal Shem Tov, which basically gave him tax-free status, which was very significant in those days because it meant that you were designated by the government, the secular government. You were designated as a rabbi or clergy, I should say. And that's very significant because, as we'll see, the Hasidic movement, which he creates, is oftentimes seen in a very different way than the traditional rabbinic ways, a traditional rabbinic position. But not yet. We're not there yet. But the reason that it's unclear is not only because of lack of documentation, but it's also unclear because what happens basically is that there becomes a very large volume of legendary stories about the Baal Shem Tov, not only in his adulthood, but even in his childhood. And even the Hasidim believe that much of this is the stuff of legend. A book comes out, the Baal Shem Tov, I don't believe, ever wrote anything, but a book from one of his Talmidim. One of his Talmidim was named Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polon, or of Polonia, and he writes a book called Todos Yaakov Yosef, which literally means the generations of Yaakov Yosef, even though it's really referring to the Baal Shem Tov. But either way, so he writes many different stories about the Baal Shem Tov, different really, you know, wondrous activities, as you can imagine, in the tradition of Hasidus. And we can't really decipher what's true and what's not true. The Hasidim themselves even say that if you believe everything in that book, so then you're a fool. But if you don't believe every, if you believe that none of it is true, so then you're a heretic. So you got to choose your poison on that one. The Baal Shem Tov of, what does that even say? Michelstadt? That's not where he was born. I don't know. Either way, I don't know. I don't know where. Maybe Michelstadt has a different name. I'm not familiar with. But either way, so he's born in a place called I think it's Okop. I'm not 100% sure, but it's in the general what was then called Moldavia, the Ottoman Empire, or the northern tip of the Ottoman Empire, and the Habsburg Empire. It's really in the general Ukraine area, although Ukraine is a sort of an amorphous piece of land during this time. Either way, we don't know much about him. We know his father's name was Eliezer. We know his mother's name was Sarah, and they lived in western Ukraine. And both his parents died at a very young age. He was an orphan at a very young age. And somehow he got to school. They say that he was not a very good student. They say he used to wander off into the forest and nobody knew where he was. And it probably didn't help that he didn't have parents that were sort of on him all the time. But either way, he definitely, according to the legends, he definitely walked to the beat of his own drum even as a child. Legends have it that he learned with angels and all these things. But basically, they say that once he got into his teenage years, he already started to support himself. He had these odds and ends jobs. He would work as the gabbai of the shul, which back then did not mean getting the people for aliyahs, but it meant taking care of the shul. And he would sleep in the shul, and he would learn Kabbalah in the shul. And they say that he taught himself Kabbalah. That's what they say. Either way, he got married, actually, I think, very early. I think he got married at the age of 18. And that woman died pretty quickly. We don't really know the circumstances there, but she died pretty quickly. And he was a widower at 18 years old, which is just difficult for anyone, and especially for a person who has no parents and really, you know, lost to the structure that he already lost when he was a kid. So he basically he used to be a teacher's assistant. This was sort of like his go-to when he was younger. He was a teacher's assistant, and he would walk the kids. A lot of stories about him walking the kids to cheder, and he would sing with them, and he would, you know, be very he'd be very loving to them, and ultimately he joined another group that basically helped other people, not just children, but also poorer people in the town. Ultimately, he also becomes a mediator. Now, what do all these, the mediator meaning, if people get in difficulty, an argument of some kind, he would be the one that would go between them. So what's the commonality between these three things? On the one hand, we have him, you know, lovingly bringing the kids to school as a teacher's assistant. We have him, you know, being part of a group that helps the poor. And then we have this concept of him being a mediator. What all three of these have in common is that the Baal Shem Tov was clearly a people person. He was a charismatic person that had an influence and an ability to connect to people from different ages and in different demographics, but nonetheless was someone who was interested in and successful at connecting with people. And this is obviously going to factor into a big part of what's going to become the Hasidic movement that he creates. At this point, he's a little over 20 years old, and there's a wealthy man, Rabbi Ephraim of Brody. Brody being the city name, and he apparently was impressed with the Baal Shem Tov's abilities to mediate between people, and he guaranteed to the Baal Shem Tov that he can marry his daughter. I think his daughter's name was Chana. So Rabbi Ephraim of Brody sort of wrote down to the Baal Shem Tov that you can marry my daughter. And what happens basically is that somehow Rabbi Ephraim passes away. And before they actually get married, or even that before Chana even finds out that she's supposed to marry this Yisrael guy, she's already orphaned. And no one believes the Baal Shem Tov that he's supposed to marry this girl. Because the Baal Shem Tov, again, was not some kind of successful, you know, established rabbi or anything like that. He was a teacher's assistant, and he was someone who, you know, mediated for people was sort of like as a side job. He wasn't some kind of well-known person at the time. So when he comes to knock on the door to marry Chana, so Chana's brother opens the door, and the brother, legend has it, thought that the Baal Shem Tov was a beggar. He thought he was coming for tzedakah. So the brother goes and gets him some tzedakah. And the Baal Shem Tov says, I'm not here for money. I'm here for your sister. He says, what do you mean, my sister? And he shows him the paper that Rabbi Ephraim of Brody, this person's father, had actually already written down. And the brother didn't believe it. And there are a lot of stories about this in terms of gaining the trust of the brother. Some interesting legends about that. But ultimately, Chana, the daughter, the sister, she says, I want to marry this guy. Dad said, our father said that this is the person I'm supposed to marry, so this is who I'm going to marry. Interestingly enough, she didn't know what the Baal Shem Tov did, and the Baal Shem Tov didn't know what he was going to do. They were somewhat of a wealthy family, but it doesn't seem like he made any money through the family. What happens apparently is he goes and he starts working in the clay business. He starts mining I don't exactly know what it means. He starts mining for minerals and he starts mining for clay, and he's got some kind of material business. And he sells this material business on this, and this is sort of like his job. And he and Chana both work in this business together. Now being a businessman, again, he's having sort of FaceTime with a lot more people again. And they ultimately settle down in the Carpathian Mountains. People know the Carpathian Mountains were sort of this, catch-all mountain region in Ukraine/Poland. My wife's grandfather grew up there in a town called Pilipets, but it was a big place. Mezhebez, where he ultimately settles, is around there. And Munkach, if people are familiar with Munkach, is around there. A lot of places that are well known that are in the Carpathian Mountains. So that's where they came. They settled down in a place called Mezhebez. And he became a shochet. This was sort of out of left field. The Baal Shem Tov apparently was a shochet. Beyond his teaching credentials and his gabbai credentials and his mediating credentials, he was a shochet. And as you can imagine, a shochet is a very important task for a person in a Jewish town, because it meant that you basically controlled the meat, the food for people. Another very face-to-face type of interaction that people all need. He also ran a tavern, another social gathering place, and they lived in the woods. Now, that might seem like the most insignificant thing that I'll say tonight, but the truth is, it might be the most significant thing, because while he's living in the woods, he starts to develop a skill of using different herbs for different medicinal purposes. Now, some people might think that means more than literal, medical things, but we're not going to get into that. He uses this knowledge, the skill that he develops while living in the woods, and actually starts to help people medically. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, where does the Baal Shem thing come into this? He's already in his mid-20s, if not 30, and you haven't said anything about the fact that he gives out amulets to people. Well, here's where it comes in. Because while he's developing the skill as an herbal doctor, there's a term for that, like an herbal healer or something like that. While he's giving people these physical healing, elixirs, that's a good word. Not what I'm looking for either, but there's a word I'm looking for. Either way, when he gives these people these medicines, these herbal, concoctions. So, Sarita, you have a guess of what I'm trying to think?
I just thought remedies.
Yes, remedy, that's what I'm thinking of. Herbal remedy is what I'm thinking of. So he's giving these people these herbal remedies, and he is mixing in not only with the physical aspect of it, the actual remedy, but also mixing in some spiritual guidance as well, right? So he's he's basically coming face to face with many vulnerable people, usually on a physical with a physical vulnerability, and he's providing them with spiritual guidance along with the physical guidance. And this develops into sort of a new type of profession. How many professions can a guy get? Right, this is probably his 10th job, and he's only 30 years old. And this is the one that's going to stick. This is the one that's going to stick because his reputation starts to grow, not only as a physical healer, but also as a spiritual healer. And as we said before, at least according to the legend, he had learned Kabbalah as a teenager. And he has all these different ideas, especially Lurianic Kabbalah of the Arizal, different, you know, the notion of nitzotzos and holiness, that every spark person can sort of unleash different sparks and it brings holiness. And his reputation grows, and the more it grows on the the more it grows from its beginnings from a physical side, right, the medicinal aspect of these herbal remedies, the more the proportion starts to shift into the spiritual aspect. Right, so the people came for the herbs and they stayed for the chassidus, because what ultimately happens is he gains a following, and we know this from different documents that he did have a following in Mezhebezh. He had a little group. We know many of his students, and this group basically becomes the foundation of chassidus. This becomes the sort of little small group that will ultimately send chassidus into the mainstream. But for the time being, it was just a small group. The Baal Shem Tov didn't do a lot of traveling. He stayed put, and he stayed in Mezhebezh. Now, this is probably a good time to talk about the importance of the Baal Shem Tov's perspective relative to the other mainstream perspective. If you think about Judaism at that time, traditional Judaism, right? There's no such thing as Reform Judaism yet. Definitely not Conservative Judaism. There's very, very little going on in the Enlightenment process. Judaism is what it always has been. You know, the people that go to yeshiva, they become the rabbis, and they go into these small shtetlach, or even, these groups of shtetlach, to sort of help these different communities, give them guidance on a halachic, in the halachic way. I remember Ricky's grandfather used to tell me that I don't think they had a rabbi in their village. That whenever they had bigger questions of halacha, so they would travel 30 miles to Munkach to speak to the Munkach Rebbe. So this is the kind of thing we're talking about. The traditional Judaism, like the leaders, were the well-educated rabbis. So I did a little chazara when I listened to, there's a Jewish historian people might be familiar with, either from online or from other venues, named Henry Abramson. Henry Abramson, I think I've might have quoted him before. So he's got talks on all these different Jewish sort of legendary characters. And when it comes to the way he formulates it, there were three things that made made success in Judaism at that time. Someone in the crowd, when he asks, what were the three things? So the person said, money, money, and money. But the truth is that money's only one of them. Because as you know, money, HaKesef Ya'aneh HaKol, Shlomo HaMelech says, the money is going to give you opportunities that other people can't get. So if you want to be successful in Judaism, in Jewish lifestyle, you got to have money. Another thing that can bring you success even without money is education. Somehow you have, a bright mind, you have the opportunity to go to a school, and that education is going to allow you the opportunities other people aren't going to get. And then thirdly, anyone want to guess what the third one is? We've got money, we have education. What's the third one?
Yichus.
Relevant to today, Yom HaMiyuchas. The other thing that's going to bring you prosperity in a Jewish lifestyle is if you have yichus. You have good connections. Your father was important. Your grandfather was important. You're connected to the banker, whatever it is. You have to have some kind of yichus. And the Baal Shem Tov comes along. And remember where the Baal Shem Tov is coming from. Who were the Baal Shem Tov's parents? We don't really know. He was orphaned when he was 4 years old. No parents. What was the Baal Shem Tov's literal educational background? Very little. He wasn't a very good student. And lastly, what was his monetary, you know, success? Very little. We just pointed out he's got all these jobs trying to make ends meet, and nothing's really working until he becomes this herbal healer. And what essentially becomes of the Baal Shem Tov's life is the movement of Hasidus, because the Hasidic movement changes the game in many ways. But in these three aspects, it actually changes the entire socioeconomic structure of a Jewish community. Whereas the people at the top either had one of these three categories, Hasidus allowed a Jewish person to be missing any of them and still feel fulfillment in Judaism. So on the one hand, this movement of Hasidus, which we know in Hasidic thought, is all about experience. It's all about feeling. It's all about emotion. It's all about feeling connected to Hashem. So those avenues, as you notice, do not require money, they do not require yichus, and they do not require an education. The feeling a person has, the connection they have, the clinging they have towards Hashem, so that's something that no money can buy, and that's something that no yichus is required for, and it's certainly something you do not need education for. Education can help, obviously, in terms of figuring out the avenues that you can connect to Hashem with. But the Baal Shem Tov basically turns everything on his head. And he says that in order for us to be successful in our own Judaism, we don't need to be born into money. And we don't need to be born into a good family or to a well-known family. And we do not need to have some, you know, very established education in a cheder for many years with a lot of yeshiva. All we need is to want to connect to Hashem. And this is what the Baal Shem Tov basically starts to preach, based, as we said before, on the concept of nitzotzos, the holiness that's within every Jew and with every aspect of the world. So all of this is what brings about this sort of groundswell of commoners, regular people, regular, even if they're poor, on the hillside, farmer type of people that are all looking for guidance, and the Baal Shem Tov gives it to them. As we said before, the Baalei Shem from before were the ones who were taking advantage of people. The people who were undereducated came to these people, and these people made them some kind of amulet and said, okay, here you go, this is your Judaism. Just hold on to this amulet. That was what they know about Judaism. The Baal Shem Tov says, you don't have to settle for such a small little aspect. You can do much more. And he starts to teach this way of Judaism, which is not relegated to money, to yichus, or to education. And ultimately, the reputation grows and grows until he has an actual following in Mezhebezh. These concepts, although somewhat innovative and popular among the common folk, really rubbed the establishment the wrong way. As you can imagine, if someone comes in and says, you don't need to get to the top of the ladder with the elements of what usually gets you to the top of the ladder, most notably education, so then what is going to be the structure in general? We're going to have a lot of, you know, what someone would call amaratzas, foolishness, people running the place which don't know who don't know what they're doing. Besides that, besides the fact that it's sort of, you know, throwing everything into some kind of upheaval of structure, there was another concern that we've talked about, I think, last month with the Ramchal, in the aftermath of which same time period, in the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi. People were very, very hesitant to allow Kabbalah to be used by the masses, right? Shabtai Tzvi was the one who came along and used Kabbalah to basically say that certain things don't have to be followed anymore, and other things are, you know, just voluntary or theoretical, right? The antinomianism that we talked about before. And because of that, combined with a couple other things we'll talk about in a second, there becomes a general pushback to this movement, right? The Hasidic movement, which focuses much more on clinging to Hashem, focuses much more on the emotional and the ecstasy of Judaism. So this experiential Judaism is something that is really uprooting the structure on a socioeconomic way, but also more importantly, it's ruining the sort of the simplicity of opening the books in a traditional way and learning what the law should be. And the fight or the struggle in this specific area really happened after the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov passes away in 1760 at the age of 60, around the age of 60. But the fight really happens 11 years later with the Maggid. But we'll talk about that in a second. This Kabbalah did not rub people the right way, or rub people the wrong way specifically. And the key for the success of Hasidus was to try to promote a certain relatability of this Kabbalah, which was not threatening the establishment. And what it does in a very nuanced way, or a very subtle way, is it brings in these concepts of personal fulfillment without the concepts of redemption. Now, of course, there's a concept of Mashiach according to Hasidim too. But the big problem with Shabtai Tzvi, and there are other historical theories about this, the biggest problem with Shabtai Tzvi was not that he used Kabbalah, but that he abused Kabbalah and manipulated Kabbalah for the sake of ushering in his words, some kind of messianic era. And Hasidism did not have any interest in that, or at least did not have any interest in promoting that. All they were doing was promoting the sense of personal fulfillment through experiential Judaism, through the ecstasy, the emotional aspect of feeling close to Hashem. And because of that, they were able to sort of, you know, skim by without the opposition. Now, there was opposition, but as I said before, they didn't have the same kind of established, or they didn't have the same approach as the establishment. So whereas Shabtai Tzvi really was working within the establishment, trying to gain the favor of the established traditional rabbis, the Baal Shem Tov didn't have any interest in that, at least at the beginning. He was doing his own thing. He wasn't trying to make any big waves in Vilna, the big city of traditional Judaism with the Vilna Gaon. He wasn't trying to convince anybody else in Warsaw or in other big towns of traditional Judaism. He was sticking to himself on the countryside, which is why there wasn't a lot of opposition to him when he was alive. When does the opposition come? The opposition comes with his students. Interestingly enough, the Baal Shem Tov, while he is credited with, now it's time for a disclaimer here, one of my outstanding projects, not really a project, but sort of a research project, I should say, is trying to get a better idea about the already existent Hasidic groups. The Baal Shem Tov, although he gets much credit for starting Hasidism, there were other small groups in the countryside that were using much similar tactics in terms of promoting a sort of experiential Judaism. And I've always wanted, if anybody knows, I've always wanted to get more, a better perspective on what was already existent before the Baal Shem Tov, to see what overlaps, what doesn't overlap, to what can we credit the Baal Shem Tov, what can't we credit the Baal Shem Tov. Either way, in history, the Baal Shem Tov is credited for the start of the theological perspective of Hasidus, with all of its nuances and sort of basic approaches. But that did not a movement make, right? The Baal Shem Tov did not make Hasidus. He might have created the theological underpinnings of Hasidus. He might have taught the sort of the approach of Hasidus. But Hasidus was created by his students. Hasidus was created by specifically the Maggid of Mezrich, who took the sort of the approach of Baal Shem Tov and said to his students, now go spread it everywhere else. The Baal Shem Tov himself never told his Talmidim, I don't think, never told his Talmidim to go spread it other places. Again, the Baal Shem Tov was very much to himself. He cared for his little group, much like other little groups around the country. The Maggid of Mezrich, Rav Dov Ber Morgenstern, was that his name? I think his name was Dov Ber. I think it was Morgenstern. The Maggid of Mezrich is the one that really creates Hasidus by telling his students to go all over the map. And that's why you have places, you have Lezhansk, and you have Anapoli, and you have Kuritz, and you have Lubavitch, you have Chernobyl, you have Satmar, you have Karlin, right? All of these are major Hasidic sects that come out because of the Magna Mezrich. The Baal Shem Tov didn't go anywhere. He stayed in Medrash. He had his little group in Medrash. Some people came to see him in Medrash, but he wasn't really into making a movement. So he really creates the underpinning of Hasidus, but he does not make the movement of Hasidus. But nonetheless, he's credited with the movement because he was the sort of the originator of the theology. So that's in terms of the Baal Shem Tov. That's in terms of where he gets started. He gets started with this. Where he really gets started theologically as a theologian or as a religious movement is through his herbal remedies, which become spiritual remedies, and then ultimately become his entire movement that we know of today. A couple other things that really are connected to what we've talked about before, but a couple of other things that are sort of the emphasis of Hasidus as opposed to what becomes known as misnagdim, the opposers of Hasidus, or Litvaks, people from Lithuania, meaning Vilna. Number one, as we've seen before, the Hasidic movement was made up originally of common people that were not well educated, and this means two things. Two very important things. Number one, the Hasidic movement, as we said, has a much less of an emphasis on learning in depth at the beginning. Much more experiential. You're dealing with people who aren't very well literate. They can't read well. They can't write well. They don't have the resources to even get a teacher. And therefore, Hasidism gets a sort of a reputation for not caring enough about learning. And this is part of the opposition from Vilna. On the flip side of the same coin, instead of an intellectual pursuit, they go through an emotional pursuit, which is very important of the day, and it has to do with the Enlightenment and bringing sort of passion out of people, etc. But what it also creates is that many Hasidic sects ultimately become so emotionally charged that that it actually becomes oppositional. Some people credit Hasidus with the concept of shuckling, which is a crazy thing to think about, that there was no shuckling before Hasidus. But either way, that's what some people claim. Another thing, in Karlin, they used to do, in Breslov, people are familiar with Breslov, they clap a lot, they scream a lot. In Karlin, they daven out loud. There was this thing called that they used to do in Karlin and other Hasidic places that the Maggid promoted until it got too opposed. Handstands. I don't know if people are familiar with the tradition of handstands in Hasidus. It was a certain practice or activity, exercise that would promote a sense of humility, that they would be lowly, right? Their head would be low down to the ground, and certain promoting that humility. So this sort of flip from the intellectual to the emotional also was very difficult for other people to digest, because it was such an upheaval, an overturning of the establishment. So that's aspect number one that was sort of part and parcel of early Hasidus. And then the other aspect, which seems like a small thing, but when you think about the structure of where Hasidism is and where traditional Judaism is, it's very different. Subtle but very important foundational difference, and that is the concept of a tzaddik. Now, what is the concept of a tzaddik? Now, we know the word tzaddik means a righteous person, but back then, what a tzaddik was for Hasidus was the person that you went to connect to God. Now, I'm not Hasidish, so I can't really understand the nuances and the subtleties of this concept. But Hasidism, as we've been talking about, is a movement that's being developed through grassroots, right? Through the common people, the common folk. And these common folk, as we said, were in many ways illiterate. They couldn't daven very well. They didn't have a very good education. So while it's true that the Baal Shem Tov promoted a certain sense of personal fulfillment through Hasidus, they still needed somebody that knew what they were doing. And the Rebbe, the tzaddik, the Rebbe of each Hasidic court, became the conduit to Hashem. And things, concepts like, you know, that the chassid should become someone who davens, that the Rebbe should daven for him, right? The Rebbe should tell him how to do certain things. And this concept, as you may well know, has become much more popular or much more structured, even in today's Hasidus, where sort of the Rebbe is sort of the top of the hierarchy, and he's protected, and he gets certain honor and glory. It was presumably not the case, despite the fact of what I said earlier in traditional Judaism, that there was always a rabbi, a posek, that you go to for halacha. It was not the case in any way that in traditional Judaism, or what we would call Litvak Judaism, that there was any sense of deification, of glorification, of overt, hierarchical honorary approaches to the Rebbe in Litvak settings. That was strictly in Hasidic courts. Nowadays, you might find a bit of a shift. You might find that in Litvak courts, there's much more of an emphasis of having a Rebbe or a Gadol Hador or a Posek Achron, things like that. In the last couple hundred years, you found that. And that might be something that we borrowed from Hasidism. But this was strictly a Hasidic concept. Now, ironically, and early Hasidus actually takes opposition to this. Ironically, Hasidus has now become, and in a couple of generations became very quickly, a patrilineal descent of Tzidkus, a patrilineal descent of a Rebbe. Now, this was, in my understanding of Hasidus, the antithesis of Hasidus at the beginning. Hasidus was for the common man. It was for anybody who could connect to God properly. It was not for the purposes of having yichus, as we said before. And all of a sudden, Hasidus sort of morphs into this concept where a Rebbe's son is going to take over as the Rebbe. And that's what we have today. Unfortunately, that is not how it always was, or it was not even planned to be. And the truth is that this really sort of is promoted in other strains of Hasidus after the Baal Shem Tov, sort of obviously. But Rabbi Elimelech of Lezhansk was very big into this. The Choza of Lublin in the same court really promoted this concept of having a Rebbe, and it really takes over all other Hasidus also. That's just how it ultimately worked. So these are really the sort of all of the different aspects of Hasidus that the Baal Shem Tov had, but then sort of was taken by his Talmidim in different ways, and some for the better, some for the worse, in terms of how they developed. Also, as you can imagine, a lot of fighting, infighting because of this, a lot of splintering, some splintering just geographic, some splintering theologic, but all in all, it all comes back to this Baal Shem Tov, who focused on personal, emotional, ecstatic Judaism, as opposed to the same intellectual, hierarchical, not hierarchical necessarily, but intellectual traditional Judaism that didn't have as much emotion involved in it. The irony is that through time, I think both Hasidus has moved towards Litvaks, and Litvaks have moved towards Hasidus, where today you'll find many people who have no ancestral Hasidic blood. You'll find them giving upsherins to their children, to their boys when they're 3 years old, completely Hasidic. You'll find many Hasidic skulas and things like that have made their way into Litvak culture. And in some ways, it's nice to see, because for a period of time of about 50 to 100 years, it was very, very frictious. It was very difficult, very hostile between the two sides, whatever sides means in this point. And it's good to see that we're sort of borrowing from each other. And the same way, Hasidus has, Hasidic yeshivas are no longer focused only on emotional, spiritual davening type things, but they also have a very rigorous focus on Talmud Torah, on learning, and it's not the same thing that it was back then. Unfortunately, certain things do crop up. We could give a whole talk about modern-day Hasidus and neo-Hasidus and how that's been promoted the last few years. But either way, very interesting to see how these things have developed. They all come back to this one figure. At least they're credited to have come in, created by the Baal Shem Tov. As you know from our Thursday night class, Pshischa on the Parsha, I am a big fan of Hasidic thought. I'm not saying that I'm Hasidish necessarily, but I myself enjoy and find a lot of meaning in Hasidus, specifically this certain brand of Hasidus, but we can talk about Pshischa another time. And I think it's nice that we can all sort of share with each other. There's no one monopoly over what Judaism is, despite the fact that when the Baal Shem Tov was starting, there was somewhat of a struggle. I think we've come a long way since then. But that's sort of the Baal Shem Tov, just to leave you with a message. The Baal Shem Tov's grandson. The Baal Shem Tov's grandson was Rav Moshe Ephraim of Sudlikov. I forgot, I don't know if he had a last name. And he writes a book called the Degel Machne Ephraim, which is in many ways mostly just the teachings of his grandfather, the Baal Shem Tov. And I thought I could share a little bit of an analogy from the Baal Shem, who is also, by the way, known as the Besht. The Besht is sort of an acronym for Baal Shem Tov. So if you ever hear someone say the Besht says, so that's the Baal Shem Tov. Some people call him the Baal Shem, etc. But so he says that we know that at Har Sinai, the pasuk tells us, "V'chol ha'am roim es hakolos," right? The people, when they were at Har Sinai, what did they see? They saw the sounds. So obviously, what does that mean? They saw the sounds. So he says, "Yesh lomar b'zeh al dash hashemati mashal min avi zekeni," right? My grandfather. Shehaya echad min a mashal is like a, as we say in Mishlei, is an analogy, a parable. There is this one person, he played a beautiful instrument. It was so sweet and it was so beautiful. All the other people around this musician that heard it, they couldn't hold themselves back from enjoying the music. Until they danced so much, they danced all the way up to the ceiling from all of the enjoyment and all of the beauty and the sweetness of the sounds. V'chol mish hayakarov yoser, anyone who was close by, hayo mikariv asma l'shmoha klizemer, everyone would come to hear this musician play. Hayo lo b'yoser tanuk, they would get such enjoyment, such pleasure. And all those people that were nearby would come and also they would enjoy. And through that, but echad cheresh, one person came, but he was deaf and he couldn't hear. He couldn't hear any of this beautiful music. All he could see were these people dancing like crazy. He thought they were crazy, the Meshuganas. What are you dancing so crazy for? The Omer Belibo. And he would say in his heart, Kilasimcha Maza Asa. What is this joy? What is this enjoyment? What is it good for? Right? This is a pasuk from Koheles. Lasimcha Maza Asa. What is this joy that you have? Uve MS, and in truth, Ilu Hayahu Chacham. If he was a wise man, this mute man, if he was wise, Viyada. V'yodea v'heaven, shehu machmas godal tag v'anil shakol shal klizemer. If he would only know that they're dancing and going crazy because of the musician, so then what would he do? Gam ken roked sham, he would also start dancing. Maybe he's not hearing the music, but he would get involved. He would see the people dancing. V'hanim shal muvan. V'yosh lomar, you could say from here, V'chol ha'am ro'im es hakolos, the Jewish people saw the sounds. What does it mean they saw the sounds? Hainu, she'Hashem yisparach hofia al kulam ke'echad, or elokuso, she'hesigu yachad kulam, k'shero godo ha'simcha. When the Jewish people saw Har Sinai, what they saw was this pure joy. Ki malachei tzvakos yedudun yedudun v'chulei, hevinu shu machmas mesikos tun imas or ha-Torah. When the Jewish people were at Har Sinai, they experienced a certain joy. They couldn't necessarily hear it fully because of where they were coming from, but they knew that what they were seeing, either literally from the angels or what they were experiencing, was something that was born out of this beauty, of this sweetness. V'dachku atzman l'shma kol ha-Torah, and they tried to hear the Torah. Afal pish hayu gitzas harashim, even though they were a little mute. Mikfar shelo hayu shomer es hakolos, hakol nasu pikhin v'ayanin pikuchin, Even though they didn't really have the ability to hear because they never heard it before and they weren't attuned to hearing the sounds, at that moment at Har Sinai, they were able to see. Right? Hashem says, Hashem made them into people that could see what was going on. They saw the joy and the pleasure that was coming. They saw that it must be through the sounds of Torah, through the words of the Torah. They understood. They didn't necessarily hear it themselves yet, but they understood that this joy and this pleasure was coming from the sweetness of the sounds of Torah. Even though they didn't necessarily fully grasp intellectually the beauty of the Torah, they understood through joy that this must be from the greatness of the beauty of Torah. Maybe they were going to hear, they were going to be able to listen a little bit more to the Torah. And this is sort of the mushel of the Baal Shem Tov to understand what does it mean. V'chol ha'am ro'am ha'sakolos. They were seeing the joy. They were seeing literally the angels dancing, and they understood through this experience that there must be some beautiful song that's going behind it. That's what it means. Ro'am ha'sakolos. This mute man. You picture this scene. This mute man seeing everyone dancing must have understood, like the Jewish people at Har Sinai was supposed to understand, that there was a certain joy that they had through a sound he couldn't hear yet. And the same thing is true of the Jewish people. Ro'im ha'sakolos, they understood, they saw the experience must have been coming from the fact that there was some kind of sound, some kind of words, some kind of message that they couldn't yet hear because of their state and their lack of background. And I thought, just reading it, you can see the corollaries, you can see the parallels to what we've been talking about today. We've been talking about tonight in Hasidic Judaism. These common people came to the Baal Shem Tov. They were like Charashim. They were mute. They didn't really have an educational background. But what did they have? They have the ability to dance. They had the ability to enjoy. They knew that there was a beauty that was running behind the Torah that they couldn't yet hear. They couldn't hear it yet. But it was that ability to dance, it was that ability to enjoy that brought them to understanding that there must be something beautiful about the Torah. And in many ways, I see within this sort of picture of Kabbalah Satorah, the paradigm or the archetype of what a Hasidic Jew is, someone who doesn't necessarily understand everything intellectually right now, but can nonetheless has the ability to emotionally connect despite their lack of knowledge. And it's very interesting just to think about as we go into Shavuos, which is we oftentimes think of as an intellectual holiday. We get the Torah to learn the mitzvos, to learn what to do, to sort of recommit ourselves to education. But on the other hand, we also have to remember, Ro'im ha'sakolos means not only understanding that there is a call, but to also be joyful about that call, to have an emotional connection to that call. So even though we might classify ourselves as Americanized, Litvak, and educated Jewish people, we can always borrow some of this sort of this emotional significance from Hasidic Judaism, and Emir Tashem, that will allow us to celebrate the Shavuos, which is the Yartzeit of the Baal Shem Tov. Shavuos is the Yartzeit of the Baal Shem Tov. This Shavuos, Emir Tashem, we should also consider the emotional connections we have to Shavuos, not just the intellectual ones. The irony, by the way, if one were to place the heads of each of these movements early on the one hand, you had the Baal Shem Tov fighting for emotional Judaism, and you had on the other side of the aisle, you had the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, fighting for intellectual Judaism, sort of traditionalists, Litvak par excellence, right? The irony is, the Baal Shem Tov passes away on Shavuos, the time for Limud HaTorah, which is not necessarily what you would think of when you think of the Baal Shem Tov and Hasidus. Early Hasidus was not necessarily focused too much on Limud HaTorah. On the other hand, the Vilna Gaon passes away on what holiday? Anyone know when the Vilna Gaon passed away? He passes away during Sukkot, the second day of Chol Hamoed, I believe. As we say in our Sukkot liturgy, Zman Simchasenu. The Vilna Gaon passes away at a time of joy and the and emotion, and the Baal Shem Tov passes away at a time of intellect. So Mirtz Hashem, we can all bring as the sort of the irony, the hashkacha of that culmination of these two figures. We can mix it together also. We can bring the complementary intellectual and emotional aspects of ourselves to bear when it comes to celebrating Shavuos in a couple days' time. So thank you all for joining me about the Baal Shem Tov, and hopefully you gained a little better perspective of where Chassidus comes from. Any feedback, any questions, concerns, suggestions, tidbits?